Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Not purchased for its own sake, like a car or broccoli.
Eliminate the broccoli possibility.
Broccoli is not the means of payment for anything else.
A car or broccoli aren't purchased for their own sake.
Therefore, you can
either.
Make people buy broccoli.
And
no.
Into a matter that I think has nothing to do with this case, broccoli. Okay?
And apparently, broccoli had nothing to do with this case. That was a mashup of questions from the bench in the oral arguments about the Affordable Care Act, when a lot of the skepticism about whether it was going to be upheld seemed to hang on the comparison that Justice Kennedy and others made with broccoli. That is, if the government can force you to buy one product, it can force you to buy other products to maintain your health, such as broccoli. But if you're just joining us and haven't yet heard, the Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act, including the individual mandate, and mostly upheld the Medicaid expansion under the law, though they did say that the federal government cannot threaten to withhold existing Medicaid funds from states that choose not to take part in the expansion. Joining us now is Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He is a co-founder of the liberal American Prospect magazine. And as some of you will remember, he was a senior health policy advisor under President Bill Clinton during that attempt to create a universal coverage system for the United States. Professor Starr, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian, on this extraordinary day.
I'm sure you're happy about this.
I am happy with it. I'm happy with the outcome. But actually, I've been reading Justice Roberts' opinion, and I'd say 95% of it takes the conservative view on the central legal issues that were presented to the court. But Roberts deviates from his fellow conservatives on only one point, and that is that the mandate can be understood as coming within the Congress's taxing authority. And because of that, it makes all the difference and the law stands.
And explain that, because I think people in the listening audience are just starting to hear this and just starting to understand it. And it's different from the ruling or the rationale for an upheld ruling that a lot of people expected. People expected that the rationale would be under the Commerce Clause, that the federal government, per the Constitution, has the power to regulate interstate commerce. Instead, it seemed to be hung on the Constitution's granting of power to the federal government to tax. Can you explain it more?
Okay. So the government, the Obama administration, made two separate arguments to the court. One was that the mandate was justified, as you said, under the Interstate Commerce Clause because people who don't have insurance, leave unpaid bills at the hospital, result in higher costs to people with insurance, and those costs get transferred into interstate commerce. That's basically the logic saying that the Interstate Commerce Clause justifies a mandate to get people to have insurance so they don't leave those unpaid bills. That's the argument there. The Chief Justice rejected that argument. But the second argument that the government made was that the really critical aspect of the mandate is that it imposes certain penalties on people who go without insurance and who don't fall into one of the many exceptions under the law. This is not well understood, but the mandate actually only applies to a very small proportion of the population, and many people without insurance would be exempt from the mandate. The Chief Justice says in his opinion, I've just been reading through it, and I haven't actually read all the way to the end, but he says that if the law can be understood as coming within the taxing authority, then the court must uphold it, regardless of whether we think it's good policy. And that is what he does. He says these penalties functionally represent a tax. Now, the law does not use the word tax. And many people thought that the court would not recognize the penalties as a tax simply because the word was not used. But the Chief Justice, unlike the other conservatives, looks past the question of the literal usage of the word tax and says, is this functionally a tax? That is, are the penalties functionally a tax? And he says they are. And because they are a tax, and Congress has that power to tax, then the law must stand.
They're also collected by the IRS, as I understand it. You would actually pay this penalty if you don't buy health insurance with your federal income tax returns. I want to start letting some of our listeners in here. It's been an hour since this ruling came down, and we haven't taken any phone calls yet because we wanted to spend a good long time really explaining to the best of our ability what is in here. So 212-433-WNYC is now open, 212-433-9692. And Brian in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Princeton Professor Paul Starr, healthcare expert. Hello.
Yes. I'm trying to understand the implications of this ruling. As I understand it, the ruling is based on the fact that the federal government has the right to tax. So going beyond healthcare, does this mean that the federal government has the right to compel you to do almost anything, and if you don't do it, they can tax you? Is that my understanding? Am I correct?
It's a fair question. Professor Starr?
Chief control that the American people have over the congressional power to tax is elections. And that's a very powerful force. Now, there are some limitations on the taxing power in the Constitution. So it's not as though they're, that's a totally unlimited power. But none of those limitations come into play in this particular case.
But to Brian, further, to follow up on Brian's question, if the Commerce Clause was not seen as relevant, then in theory, they could tax you if you don't buy broccoli or buy automobiles or whatever else they want to tax you if you don't buy, and couldn't that in effect become carte blanche for the government to force you to buy any product as long as they say the penalty would be to pay a tax?
Well,
because the government
could impose a tax on broccoli. It could impose an excise tax
on not buying broccoli.
That's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure how that would possibly work. As I said, the chief control that the public has, it's a control that the public will exercise this November, is through elections. That's the greatest limitation on the taxing power.
That's what stops the federal government from doing things that are seen as too onerous by too many of the people. And in fact, that political process will continue with respect to the Affordable Care Act, even though the Supreme Court has ruled it constitutional. That is just the baseline type of legitimacy. Okay, it doesn't violate the Constitution. There's still a repeal movement. And in fact, the reaction this morning included this clip that we're about to play from Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate Republican leader, Republican from Kentucky. He's speaking here on the Senate floor, urging a full repeal.
This was one of the Democrats' top selling points, because they knew it would never have passed if they said it was a tax. Well, the Supreme Court has spoken. This law is a tax. The bill was sold to the American people on a deception. But it's not just that the promises about this law weren't kept. It's that it made the problems it was meant to solve even worse. But I can assure you of this. Republicans won't let up whatsoever in our determination to repeal this terrible law and replace it with the kind of reforms that will truly address the problems it was meant to solve.
So Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor moments ago. Here's a reaction from Governor Christie's office. It says Governor Chris Christie released the following statement regarding today's decision. Quote, I've been clear from the very beginning that I do not believe a one-size-fits-all health care program works for the entire country, and that each governor should have the ability to make decisions about what works best for their state. Today's Supreme Court decision is disappointing, and I still believe this is the wrong approach for the people of New Jersey, who should be able to make their own judgments about health care. Most importantly, the Supreme Court is confirming what we knew all along about this law. It is a tax on middle-class Americans. Now, Professor Starr, this goes to the one limitation that the court did place on the Affordable Care Act today and on the federal government. It said that the feds cannot penalize states that do not choose to participate in the Medicaid expansion that is part of this law. They can offer incentives, like we'll cover all or most of the Medicaid expansion for X number of years, but they can't threaten to withhold existing Medicaid funds if states choose not to go along. So do you think that we will see a governor like Chris Christie, and interestingly, he didn't say one way or another in this initial reaction, now say, okay, this Medicaid expansion to put a lot more people on Medicaid, this is going to cost my state money, so I'm not going along with this. And now it becomes a 50-state battle, state by state by state, for what is at least as significant, maybe more significant than the individual mandate in terms of how many more Americans get health insurance under this, this expansion of Medicaid.
So, Brian, the Medicaid program originally was voluntary. In fact, the program as a whole continues to be voluntary for the states. And some states initially did not go into Medicaid. Arizona did not have a Medicaid program until the 1980s. But what happened over time, of course, is that many of the states that were foregoing the federal money decided that this is nuts. We're giving up a lot of money that could be coming into our state's healthcare system. And so over time, all the states came into the Medicaid program. I think the same thing is going to happen here. So you have to understand, for the enlarged coverage under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government pays 100% of the new costs for the first 3 years. And then it goes down to 90%. So the states actually bear a very small proportion of the cost for expanding Medicaid. And the hospitals and the doctors and other healthcare providers around the country are going to want to have that revenue coming in. They are going to be heard in the state capitals. And so although I think some of the red states will initially say no, I don't think that will persist over time.
Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He was one of the lead people involved in President Clinton's attempt to get universal coverage in America. Thank you very much for joining us. And with us now is Jamal Green, professor of law at Columbia University. He clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens. Professor Green, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Are you shocked that Chief Justice Roberts was the swing voter here, not Justice Kennedy? Justice Kennedy voted with the conservatives, and Chief Justice John Roberts made it possible to have this 5-4 decision upholding President Obama's health reform law.
You know, I think it is it's certainly surprising that Justice Kennedy was not in the majority here, given that Roberts was. But there's actually some evidence, if you look at Roberts' decision-making over the last several years, that he's not quite as enamored of sort of states' rights arguments and sort of anti-federal power arguments as Justice Kennedy is. So if you were going to pick someone to be that fifth vote, it's not actually that surprising that it would be Roberts. But I, like everyone else, thought that if this was upheld, it'd be and Roberts was in the majority, he would also have Kennedy with him.
And being tweeted now is this from Jeffrey Toobin, CNN's legal analyst, who was so widely quoted after the oral arguments. People remember he was saying, you know, this health care law is toast based on the tough questioning of Justice Kennedy and some of the others. He writes now, the big winner at the Supreme Court today is Don Verrilli, the Solicitor General. Among the losers, Toobin writes, is me, who was so critical of his oral argument. And you know, I think Professor Green, everybody was critical of Verrilli's argument. He was hesitant. He wasn't forceful. There were things that people thought he should have included that he didn't include. Does this mean that oral arguments just don't really matter that much on a case that's this momentous because there's so much else that the justices have to go on?
Well, I do think that sometimes you really can't tell, though what it must be said that on the Commerce Clause question, which was the question that Solicitor General Verrilli spent most of the time on, he actually loses. Right? So Chief Justice Roberts actually says that the mandate exceeds the Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, and under the Necessary and Proper Clause, upholds it on a ground that the government supported but really didn't spend much time on. So if you're going to be reading oral arguments, it's actually, you know, you could actually say that, that you know, the part that we spent, that everyone criticized, he actually did lose on.
And, in fact, let's go back to the oral arguments and play this 35-second clip. This is an exchange between Justice Kagan, who, of course, was sympathetic, and General Verrilli.
Suppose a person does not purchase insurance, a person who is obligated to do so under the statute, doesn't do it, pays the penalty instead. And that person finds herself in a position where she's asked the question, have you ever violated any federal law? Would that person have violated a federal law?
No. Our position is that that person should give the answer no.
And that's because?
That if they don't pay the tax, they violated a federal law.
But as long as they've paid the penalty.
If they've paid the tax, then they're in compliance with the law.
Why do you keep saying tax?
So that was a laugh line at the time, but sure enough, even though the word tax was not in the law, Justice Roberts upheld this because it's a tax and the government has the power to impose a tax.
Right, and that really is the key exchange because, right, the question is, right, if you don't, are you a criminal if you don't purchase insurance and don't have any health insurance? And Chief Justice Roberts says, look, it's a relatively modest tax relative to what some other taxes could be, and relative to the cost of insurance in some cases. And so this is really giving you a choice between paying a tax to the IRS or buying insurance.
There was some confusion that we were trying to clear up earlier about whether people could refuse to pay the tax in any way, and whether there was something in the Chief Justice's decision that seemed to enable that. Did you see anything like that?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts does say that it doesn't, and I'm still parsing this opinion like everyone else, but Chief Justice Roberts does say that not buying insurance doesn't mean that you're subject to penalties other than increasing your tax payment. So the way this tax is actually collected is if you sign something on your tax form, your tax return, saying, you know, I have qualifying health insurance coverage, and if you don't check that box, then the way in which your taxes are calculated gives you a higher tax burden, right? So if you have a refund, your refund's going to be smaller. It's basically the way it works, and there's no other penalty. So if you just refuse to pay your taxes, well, then like any other instance of not paying your taxes, you're going to have to be subject to some consequences. But there's no specific consequence attached to not paying this particular penalty.
By the way, that was Justice Breyer's voice at the end of the exchange between Kagan and Verrilli. Justice Breyer, who said, why do you keep saying tax? And got the laugh from the crowd there. I know you have to go in a minute. The chief's opinion is 59 pages. Justice Ginsburg's opinion concurring is 61 pages. The four dissenters are 65 pages, followed by a short two-pager from Justice Thomas. Is this an unusual amount of writing?
Not for an opinion this large. If you look back to Citizens United and look back to some of the other big cases recently, this is a court that likes to talk. And I think it's not surprising that the opinions would be this long.
Jamal Green, professor of law at Columbia University. He was a clerk for Justice John Paul Stevens. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act. Our coverage continues. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. If you're just joining us, the Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act, almost the whole thing, including the individual mandate and most of the Medicaid expansion. The states, however, may choose not to participate in the Medicaid expansion to cover more people, more with higher incomes, under Medicaid if they choose not to spend the money. But basically, the Affordable Care Act has been upheld on a 5-4 vote, with Chief Justice Roberts as the swing voter with the liberals on the court. the usual swing voter, Justice Kennedy, voted with the conservatives. Let's get to some of your reactions. Our lines are full. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. John in Red Hook, you're on the air. John, thanks for your patience.
Hey, Lennon, good morning. Listen, the logic they use to consider this a tax is ludicrous, because outside of the income tax, any tax that a citizen incurs is by voluntarily entering into a commercial transaction. If I don't buy a house, I don't pay property taxes, I don't pay a water bill. If I don't buy that pair of Levi's, I don't pay the sales tax. This is like the mob coming up to us and say, hey, you know what? You need protection, but we're not going to call it a shakedown. We're going to call it a tax.
It is a different kind of tax than I could think of in any other case. It's a tax for not doing something, which is what I think you're pointing out, as opposed to a tax for doing something.
Right, but it's taking our choice, our free will, what this country was built on, freedom, my freedom of choice. If I want to buy the house, then I am obligated by entering into that transaction to pay the water tax, to pay my property bill. But if I don't, it's like saying, buy the house. Why can't the government say, you know, we want everybody in a house? And you have to pay those taxes.
Well, you're not free to do anything. You're not free to take off your clothes and run down the street in public. And what the government is trying to do here is say, you're not free to shirk a responsibility and put all the other taxpayers' finances at risk by having such a huge burden on everybody else for charity care, right? The state of New Jersey, for example, pays $1 billion a year in taxpayer money to cover the medical expenses of people who are uninsured. Now, that's a double dip, kind of a double tax for people who choose to have insurance but also have to pay their ordinary taxes to the state, because other people aren't buying health insurance, and so there are people uncovered out there.
Yeah, but Brian, I agree with you there. There's a quandary where if people don't have insurance, it's put on the backs. But we're not free to do certain things, and now we're not free to not do certain things. Where does it stop? Why don't we change the system? You know, it's absolutely ludicrous that we say, you know what, we have to tax that. How many wars are we fighting? There's always money for war, but there's no money for health care. You know, and if you rearrange the system and our priorities, we wouldn't have to tax everybody to death.
John, I'm going to move on. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your arguments. And Paul in Peekskill, you're on WNYC. Hello, Paul.
Hi. I have one point and one question to raise. Justice Roberts and this tax issue, as was explained by your first guest, is really encouraging to me. And to me, the Roberts, where he lays on this decision, points out the need for that the Constitution and life is more nuanced than just the extreme liberals and conservatives would like to present it, and a more vibrant centrism maybe helps us understand the nuances and raises the question of with the understanding of the tax function that your first guest explained, that there's a higher level of functional literacy as to how things really work. Is more in the centrist point of view than the extreme right or the left.
Thank you very much, Paul, for that that observation. I guess that comes down to centrism is alive in the United States, says Paul. By the way, we're just getting word that Mitt Romney is scheduled to make a public reaction to this ruling at 11:45. So if we can bring that to you live, we absolutely will. Rich in Long Beach, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rich.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. You know, the Supreme Court justices in a 5-4 decision, these are supposed to be 9 intellectuals who are supposed to be looking at laws like Obamacare as to being constitutional, not unconstitutional, and other issues before the Supreme Court as well. And intellectuals are supposed to be looking at things as whether being constitutional or not, not bringing the ideology, these ideologue views into the point of view, and to have a couple of justices say the entire thing is unconstitutional, and then have the other side, especially Roberts and Bush the Elder, must be rolling his eyes right now to have this come back and haunt him. But the economic impact that this is going to have, and you're talking in your first guest when you were talking about freedoms and a double taxation because whether you have insurance or not insurance, you're a taxpayer, blah, blah, blah. The economic burden this is going to put on hospitals and communities, and I think that's something a lot of people are overlooking, is the fact that the economic burden, these hospital emergencies are already filled up with people don't have health insurance, and now it's just going to be doubled and tripled as people come in because I got a fever, I got this, I got that, and it's not even serious care that's needed, and this is really going to open us up to people who are citizens or not citizens just absolutely flooding the emergency rooms in this country because of Obamacare, and the economic impact of small communities, never mind the states, is going to be devastating.
Well, the Obama administration would argue that the opposite is actually true, that because the burden of payment will be spread around to so many more people buying health insurance, and because so many more people will be covered with health insurance, that those going to emergency rooms for routine care and for charity care in general will actually go down. Also, that health insurance will become more affordable. Remember, it's called the Affordable Care Act, and I know that people disagree genuinely on whether this is going to cost the government more or the government less over time. That has more to do with the Medicare provisions. But the idea here is to have an intervention in the market so that the costs actually come down. And on the intellectuals, everybody says the Supreme Court is filled with politicians now when they're supposed to be people interpreting the Constitution. In their defense, most serious people who cover the court, like Nina Totenberg and Linda Greenhouse, who used to do it for the Times, have come on the show and said, you know, not really. They legitimately disagree because intellectuals, if they're independent intellectuals, will disagree on fundamental things like how to interpret the Constitution of the United States, which can be vague on a lot of things. So maybe, Rich, they deserve a little more credit than that.
Well, your point about the federal government paying 100% of this for the first couple of years, we're already running a huge multiplying deficit by this administration, and having the government can pay for all this Obamacare, where are they going to get the money from? Not only are you going to have to pay a tax on not getting health insurance, they're going to raise your taxes somewhere down the line because you cannot continually run a socialist government like this or a socialism society and pay for this out of the pockets of people like myself who have jobs.
Rich, thank you. It is possible because you're right. The individual mandate is meant to force down the cost of insurance in the private sector because the insurance companies will have more customers. And so they can spread that risk around and the cost of insurance may not go down, but it won't go up as fast as it would have otherwise, is the argument. With respect to the government is certainly taking on more of an expense burden here, at least at the start. And so let's get another reaction right now from a supporter of the law. He is Tom Perriello, former congressman from Virginia. He is now president and CEO of the Center for American Progress Action Fund to discuss the progressive response to the decision. Congressman Perriello, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back, particularly on such a good day.
Do you want to respond to that last caller? Were you listening?
I wasn't hearing all of it, but I think I heard the person before talking about this issue of how this is going to work. And I think that, the key here is that it's going to actually take a lot of the burden off of people who already have insurance, who have been carrying the burden for the uninsured. It creates a more competitive market. And we know that in our system is about economic competition, and we know we haven't really had that in a meaningful way. But a lot of it comes down to the fact that the healthcare decisions in our system, and I'm a son of a doctor and a brother of a doctor, have been taken out of doctors' hands by the health insurance companies, and we're handing this back to the doctors and the patients to be able to make their healthcare decisions. And the Republicans have wanted to protect the health insurance companies to be able to make those decisions instead of patients and doctors. And this is just a huge victory for people. You see that in not just the 30 million people who are going to have access to care. Being a woman is no longer going to be a pre-existing condition where women can be charged 50% more and denied pre- and postnatal care. This is really an incredibly complex approach to a very complex problem, and the Supreme Court today said, if the Republicans want to try to hide behind a legal excuse for protecting the insurance companies, we're not going to give it to them. We're going to stand with the Constitution, and that was a good thing.
Well, one of the arguments that the last caller was making was that this is going to cost the taxpayers a lot more money and might result in yet another tax, since this is being redefined as a tax, because the Medicaid provision was upheld, the federal was mostly upheld. The federal government has promised the states that the feds will pay 100% of this expansion of Medicaid for the first number of years, and after that, 90%, as our previous guest Paul Starr was pointing out. So this is going to cost the taxpayers more money. They've got to get the money in Washington somehow to expand Medicaid to cover more people, right?
Well, if you look at what we did, if you just take the Medicare provisions, for example, we got all 100% of that funding to extend Medicare from going after waste
Medicaid?
Medicaid? No, I'm talking about the Medicare now. So on the Medicare provision,
for senior
we went
citizens.
After waste, fraud, and abuse in the system in order to be able to reward the people that are working hard and playing by the rules. And working with the states on the Medicaid provisions, I think there's an understanding, particularly among the working poor and others, that this is an extremely important part of the system and that people who are moving into the workforce aren't punished in terms of their health care coverage for that. And I think it's appropriate for that to not be a completely unfunded mandate to the states, which are on very tough economic times right now, to move in that direction.
How concerned are you about the one thing that the court did limit with respect to the Affordable Care Act, and that is the ability of the federal government to threaten the states with withholding the Medicaid funding that they get now if they choose not to participate in the expansion?
Well, I think what you see is these sort of conflicting arguments from the right falling apart. One side said this is such a good deal for the states that it's almost coercive, and the other side is, oh, you're being so mean to the states by punishing to take away the funding. They kind of had to pick one argument or the other, and I think what the court said is, look, you can't punish to take away what's already there in terms of support for Medicaid. But obviously it's okay to go to the states and say, hey, we're going to cover 100% to 95% of the burden to make sure that some of the most vulnerable get covered. States can decide on that. It would be, I think, a pretty outrageous thing for governors and legislatures to decide not to do that would in fact impose enormous costs on their state because there are folks who are going to end up in the healthcare system dumping that cost either onto public dollars or to those of us who have private insurance. So, states can make that decision. But I think when you get the rhetoric out of the way and look at the substance, it's a very good deal for states, it would be very surprising to see if governors go. But I think one of the things you get at here is that in some ways all the attention has been on Capitol Hill and right across the street at the Supreme Court. Now much of the attention comes to the state level, where governors, Republican and Democratic governors, have to decide how to implement this, how to implement the exchanges, how to implement the Medicaid provisions. And sometimes we actually see more functionality at the state government level than the federal government level. What could be exciting would be to see, states take slightly different approaches. And that, again, is its own form of competition, which was envisioned in the law to see how this works. And I think what we need to look at in terms of Congress is, this debate's done in Congress. Let's focus on jobs. The president has a jobs bill there that the Republicans in the House have refused to move on for a year. That's what's foremost on people's minds. And let's let this move into the implementation stage now that the court's upheld it.
Though it looks like that's not what's going to happen. We played the comment earlier from Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor a few minutes ago when he said full speed ahead with the repeal Obamacare movement. We're going to hear from Speaker Boehner, I think, any minute. We'll carry that live if we can. We're also expecting to hear from Mitt Romney any minute, and we'll carry that live if we can. I assume they won't speak at the same time. But one more thing for you, Congressman Perillo.
Yeah.
We had an earlier caller who said, okay, so the Supreme Court decided that this is not a requirement that every American buy something. This is a tax. And so this is not a precedent for the government to start telling people you have to buy broccoli, you have to buy this, you have to buy that. But he said he doesn't like it because it is carte blanche for the government to say, well, if you don't do this, we can tax you. If you don't do that, we can tax you. When today, the only thing that government actually taxes is things that you do. If you buy something, you pay a sales tax. If you earn money, you pay an income tax. Now, if you decide not to do something, the government can make you pay a tax for deciding not to do it. And he finds that a dangerous precedent to set in terms of individual freedom. How would you respond to that?
Well, we have an old, libertarian notion in this country that I have a right to move my fist right up into the point that it comes into contact with your nose. And I think for most things, my moving my hand around does not affect the other person. But the reason in terms of driving insurance and health insurance is that we are inevitably interconnected. If someone has no insurance and they go out and wrap themselves around a tree and end up with 60 years of very expensive care, we all pick up the tab for that, whether it's through a Medicaid program or through our health insurance premiums. So there's a way in which inevitably the fist and the nose come together in a very limited number of areas. So I think the idea that this is going to spread into everything else, and if you look at Justice Roberts' decision, it was extremely narrow, and I think that's not surprising in terms of how he wrote it, that we're looking at a very narrow decision that says in these situations where that fist and nose are inevitably linked, we have a different kind of thing going on here, and people can either opt to pay the tax or to get the insurance company, get the insurance coverage. And, back to very quickly your other point about McConnell and Boehner's statements. They don't ask me for advice, but I really think this idea of going and relitigating this battle with more votes when people want to see them move the jobs bill forward, move these middle class relief bills forward, for them to go back and focus on this. I think people are tired of it. They say, okay, it survived the court. Let's see how this thing works in action.
Tom Perillo, former Democratic congressman from Virginia, now president and CEO of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The Supreme Court upholds the Affordable Care Act. We'll take more of your calls in a minute, and we're expecting a statement from Mitt Romney. We will carry it live. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our coverage today of the Supreme Court's landmark ruling upholding the Affordable Care Act, obviously pivotal to the election year, such a crucial election year victory for the Democratic incumbent president. It also marks a pivotal point in the presidential race. Republican challenger Mitt Romney opposes the health care overhaul and is expected to double down on his campaign pledge to repeal the law if he is elected. In fact, there is a podium set up where Romney is expected to speak right now, and the podium has a sign that reads, "Repeal and Replace Obamacare." So he's not apparently going to slink away and focus on other things now, but try to capitalize on the outrage of Republicans and some others, as we've been hearing from some of our callers, that President Obama and then the Supreme Court would impose such a thing. We'll continue to take your reactions. Our lines are full. You can get in when people finish their calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As we await Mitt Romney, Alan in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I was thinking about the recent New Yorker article about the Supreme Court and the role of Charles Evans Hughes in carefully moving back and forth between the left and right when it looked like the court's authority was being undermined in the public eye in the FDR legislation for the New Deal. And he switched from the liberal to the conservative and back to the liberal side to avoid having the court seem too far off in the extreme. Roberts may be trying to do that sort of thing, but at the time, what I was struck by is FDR argued for packing the court by adding one justice for each one over 70. And I would argue that the better measure here is not how old a justice is, but how long ago he was ratified and how much distance there is in time between the time of ratification and the age of existing voters. If you have voters now who were born more than 21 years after the vote to elect the senators who ratified a justice back under Reagan in the 90s or the 80s or Thomas in the early 90s, these voters had no say in selecting that justice. And they were, they're now adults, and their parents might have voted for or against the senators who ratified these people.
Right.
So,
although part of the idea of judicial independence from the actual political sector, the other two branches of government, is supposed to be secured by having the justices have these lifetime appointments and so not be subject to political whims.
Well, that's a good argument for having them be free of the fear of being thrown out except for impeachable offenses. But since the lifespan of justices has expanded radically since the time that judicial review was approved by John Marshall, mm-hmm. virtually everyone alive at the time he passed that doctrine was alive at the time he and his Supreme Court were seated. So there was almost no gap between the constituency right. that approved that
I
court
understand what you're saying.
And the court at the right. date the ruling
right.
came down.
Interesting. Alan, thank you very much. And an interesting historical point about that justice in the FDR era. That may well be what Chief Justice Roberts is trying to do. He may or may not ever say. I think he's supposed to teach a course in Malta beginning on July 1st or so I've heard. And so maybe people will have an opportunity then to at least ask him to put himself on the record as to why he did something that was so uncharacteristic in terms of his past voting record. But justices, certainly chief justices, do worry about the reputation of the court. And perhaps he was trying to make it more centrist if he feared it was losing some credibility as being just a political body that was going to vote along partisan lines rather than constitutional lines. Jerry in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah. The point I wanted to make is that the discussion is sort of devoid of the context of political economy, except on the periphery. If you look at the position and the perspectives of the insurance companies, of the drug companies, of the equipment companies, I'm talking about General Electric and General Dynamics, the multinational drug companies, and the insurance, which are a representative of finance capital. That's what insurance companies are. So you have multinational capital and finance capital that is in support of the Obamacare because they recognize that their interests are greatly endangered unless something is put in place very rapidly because the alternative is a Medicare for All program. And this, of course, is the devil. So that what I think has happened is that that Roberts understands the nature of power. And just like these centers of power, of neoliberal power, because that's what the essence of the power is, finance and multinational capital, he understands the necessity of responding to their sense mm-hmm. of what is necessary in order to reproduce the system.
Yeah,
to reproduce social and economic and political power. And they're the ones who put Romney into the candidacy.
Well,
we know that.
Jerry, a lot of what you say may be true. Of course, different industries had different positions with respect to the law. You probably remember that
yes,
the Obama
administration.
Wait, let me finish. The Obama administration. Hang on. The Obama administration struck that deal with the pharmaceutical companies that certainly some progressives really held their noses at, which basically said we won't allow importing the cheaper priced drugs that you make from Canada or elsewhere if you go along with this law in general. So that was certainly a deal between government and the insurance lobby, the insurance industry, pharmaceutical industry. The insurance companies continued to oppose the law, even though it seems to me they get an incredible windfall from it under the individual mandate. Everybody in America is now required to buy their product. How great is that? We have Governor Romney, we believe now, about to walk to his podium in 60 seconds. We're going to give those 60 seconds to Anna in Shortsville. Hi, Anna.
Yes, hi. It's in Short Hills.
Oh, you're in Short Hills. Hi. Yeah,
yes.
New Jersey.
I have two comments. First one, I applaud the Supreme Court for this decision. And the second one is in regard to the gentleman who said that when he buys a house or he buys a car, he pays taxes on it. And when he doesn't have it, he doesn't have to pay taxes. He's considering health insurance as a tax. It's not. It's insurance. When we buy a house, we pay taxes and we pay insurance. When we buy a car, we pay taxes and we pay insurance. And the day we are born, we need to pay something, at least our parents, for our kids.
And
I'm going to
jump out because here's Governor Romney.
I agree with the dissent. What the court did not do on its last day in session, I will do on my first day if elected president of the United States. And that is, I will act to repeal Obamacare. Let's make clear that we understand what the court did and did not do. What the court did today was say that Obamacare does not violate the Constitution. What they did not do was say that Obamacare is good law or that it's good policy. Obamacare was bad policy yesterday. It's bad policy today. Obamacare was bad law yesterday. It's bad law today. Let me tell you why I say that. Obamacare raises taxes on the American people by approximately $500 billion. Obamacare cuts Medicare by approximately $500 billion. And even with those cuts and tax increases, Obamacare adds trillions to our deficits and to our national debt and pushes those obligations on to coming generations. Obamacare also means that for up to 20 million Americans, they will lose the insurance they currently have, the insurance that they like and they want to keep. Obamacare is a job killer. Businesses across the country have been asked what the impact is of Obamacare. Three-quarters of those surveyed by the Chamber of Commerce said Obamacare makes it less likely for them to hire people. And perhaps most troubling of all, Obamacare puts the federal government between you and your doctor. For all those reasons, it's important for us to repeal and replace Obamacare. What are some of the things that we'll keep in place and must be in place in a reform, a real reform of our healthcare system? One, we have to make sure that people who want to keep their current insurance will be able to do so. Having 20 million people, up to that number of people, lose the insurance they want is simply unacceptable. Number two, got to make sure that those people who have pre-existing conditions know that they will be able to be insured and they will not lose their insurance. We also have to assure that we do our very best to help each state in their effort to assure that every American has access to affordable health care. And something that Obamacare does not do that must be done in real reform is helping lower the cost of health care and health insurance. It's becoming prohibitively expensive. And so this is now a time for the American people to make a choice. You can choose whether you want to have a larger and larger government, more and more intrusive in your life, separating you and your doctor, whether you're comfortable with more deficits, higher debt that we pass on to the coming generations, whether you're willing to have the government put in place a plan that potentially causes you to lose the insurance that you like, or whether instead you want to return to a time when the American people will have their own choice in health care, where consumers will be able to make their choices as to what kind of health insurance they want. This is a time of choice for the American people. Our mission is clear. If we want to get rid of Obamacare, we're going to have to replace President Obama. My mission is to make sure we do exactly that, that we return to the American people the privilege they've always had to live their lives in the way they feel most appropriate, where we don't pass on to coming generations massive deficits and debt, where we don't have a setting where jobs are lost. If we want good jobs and a bright economic future for ourselves and for our kids, we must replace Obamacare. That is my mission, that is our work, and I'm asking the people of America to join me. If you don't want the course that President Obama has put us on, if you want instead a course that the founders envisioned, then join me in this effort. Help us. Help us defeat Obamacare. Help us defeat the liberal agenda that makes government too big, too intrusive, and that's killing jobs across this great country. Thank you so much.
Former Massachusetts governor and Republican presidential presumed nominee Mitt Romney making it clear in no uncertain terms that regardless of what the Supreme Court said is constitutional, he still considers the Obama health reform law bad policy. And on day one, he will do everything he can to see that the law is repealed if he is elected president. Again, folks, if you're just joining us and haven't yet heard, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 today that the Obama health reform law is constitutional, including the hotly contested individual mandate. Also, most of the expansion of Medicaid was upheld, despite a lawsuit against that by 26 states. Our coverage will continue with special coverage from NPR Next. Thank you for listening this morning. Keep commenting on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show or join the live chat that's going on our politics website. It's a freecountry.org.